It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 252-247-7282, and let's talk legal.
Yeah, let's do this. Let's talk legal. Welcome, Wes and Cecil, again.
Good morning.
It's our Tuesday segment.
It is. Good morning, Mike.
We had good conversation over the past couple weeks with Durable Power of Attorney. And today, Cecil, we're going to talk about wills and the mental capacity to create such.
Let's talk about that. And right out of the gate, Mike, let's get some words here out and about, which is basically capacity and the word competency. These two words get confused, it seems, when it comes to making out a last will and testament, or maybe signing a trust, even a durable power of attorney, any kind of material document in your estate. But most particularly, we're going to talk about the last will and testament. And many folks will make the comment, well, I really don't think my loved one, you know, was competent. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they had the competency to make out that document. Of course, the law distinguishes between competency and capacity. And the key element of making out last will and testament is that we have capacity. And capacity is very specifically then outlined in our law in the state of North Carolina. And we're going to talk about that. But I wanted to put out there at the beginning the fact that, you know, the word and the definition that we're really discussing this morning is whether or not the client has legal capacity to make out a last will and testament.
Okay. Always an adjective in front of those nice words. So it's a legal capacity and competency, legal competency. So you've introduced the word. Now, is there a simple definition for both?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, also it's referred to as testamentary capacity, you know, capacity to enter a will. It's also the same capacity with regard to trust and those type things. We also have capacity as it relates to signing contracts, those type things. And then we contrast that to the word, like Cecil indicated, of competency. You know, so when does all this come up? We're going to break this down in just a moment.
Sure.
But, you know, when does all of this come up? Well, obviously it comes up, you know, front and foremost with the lawyers here when we're meeting with someone who is interested in entering a will, because the capacity at play is the capacity that the person has at the time they're actually executing the document. You know, it's not a year before, it's not 6 months after, it's at the time of executing the document. That's what all of our cases say. Of course, you know, we can look at evidence around that period of time. I mean, obviously, if someone has, you know, advanced stage Alzheimer's to the point where they don't know who they are, who their family members are, so on and so forth, 3 months before they signed the document, they probably didn't have it when they signed it either.
Right.
You know, so, you know, you have to look at that. So this comes up, obviously, you know, when we're meeting with folks who are interested in signing these type of testamentary documents. And it also comes up, you know, when there's a challenge to the documents. In many cases, when there's a challenge to a will, for example, that's called a will caveat. One of the basis upon which the caveat would be filed would be, you know, the person's arguing my father, my mother, my loved one lacked testamentary capacity at the time that they signed the document. So, you know, us attorneys, when we meet with folks, and they're interested in signing a will, you know, we ask the questions. We ask questions like, well, tell me who your family is. Okay, we ask the questions. Tell me, let's get my notes together here about what assets you have. What property do you own? Do you own your home? You know, where is that located? Do you bank anywhere in particular? Do you have any stocks, bonds? You own any vehicles, life insurance? Things like that. You kind of ask these open-ended questions instead of, you know, Mr. Smith, now your children are Sue, Sally, and Steve, right?
Yeah,
well, that would be easy
questions.
For to say yes,
yeah,
right? So the better way to do that as the attorney is to ask the open-ended questions so the person can then answer the question And then you could have your notes there indicating, yes, he was able to provide all of this information, which is, you know, could be very valuable if there's a challenge,
sure,
you know, later on. So following that procedure every time as the attorney is important. We do run into situations where, you know, we get with the client. Maybe we have to go to the hospital. Maybe we have to go to a nursing home. Maybe the person is at home and we're having to go to them. Or even in a much rarer situation, maybe they're at our office and we ask these questions that they just can't answer them. And then we're in a position where we have to evaluate whether there's capacity or not. In the event that we find that there's not, then we've got to push pause, because we're certainly not going to, you know, put a client out there in a position, or family in a position, or certainly the attorney in a position where we're having documents signed where the person doesn't have capacity. So kind of the rubber hits the road,
yeah,
right there at the beginning when the document's being signed.
So, and when you're having this conversation, Wes, with a client,
right,
and are you the arbiter of their capacity or not having capacity? Is it your call?
It would be my call, but ultimately if it's challenged, it's the jury's call. So, but I know what the standard is.
You know what the standard is. And from this discussion you're having with your client, you're
right,
taking notes, so
right,
you have a record of it in the event that it were to be challenged down the road somewhere.
No doubt about that. In cases we've had in the past where there's been a challenge to a will, which doesn't happen all that often, but sometimes you might have a disgruntled child because they weren't involved in the person's, yeah, family, but they still want their chunk of the pie, their
absolutely
piece of the pie.
Sure.
In the notes of the attorney who met with the client, the testator, in order to put down the information about family, assets, all these kind of things, those are always very valuable, you know, very valuable pieces of information, very valuable evidence, because then the attorney can simply testify, I gather this information from my client, from the testator. Well, if he didn't or she didn't have testamentary capacity, well, how are we getting this information here if we just met with the client regarding the names of the children, regarding the spouse's name, regarding the property that's owned, regarding where the bank accounts or account may be, where the stocks may be? So, yes, that list of information that we gather obviously is helpful for the attorney, just so we have a good baseline as it relates to our client,
yeah,
but it also can prove to be very valuable in the event there is a challenge in the future. And I tell you, you know, in my years of dealing with these cases, when you have a situation where a client went to an attorney's office, sat down with a lawyer, the lawyer prepared the document, the witnesses were brought in, the notary's there, All of the pomp and circumstance was followed. The procedure was followed. The ceremony was followed. And that was done right under the eyes of an attorney who knows what he or she is doing with regard to testamentary capacity. The likelihood a will under that scenario is going to be challenged successfully is incredibly low,
very,
compared
very
to the print off the internet, stick it in front of them.
Yeah.
I mean, the jury hears all these things.
Sure.
So, you know, if you print it off the internet, stick it in front of them, mm-hmm, and it happens to not be, you know, what you would think this person would,
yeah,
do, ooh, that one's already smoking a little bit. Where there's smoke, there's fire, right?
That's right, yeah. Buyer beware. or you get what you pay for. Cecil, you want to,
yeah,
add to this?
So, Mike, you know, this is an area where, you know, it isn't much as we've discussed thus far this morning. We maybe will continue to discuss this next week. You know, many times this is not so black and white.
Right.
I mean, the challenge for an experienced lawyer is when there might be a little bit gray. And so there are certainly times when we as the lawyer will want there to be a letter from the physician that we feel, that the physician feels, that this client has capacity to know his family, to know his belongings, to know how to make a legal document. Doctors tend to make these letters or little statements or medical notes in their own way, but we lawyers then can read them and tell that what they're really saying is that Mr. Jones or Mrs. Jones really is just fine here. You look at all of the circumstances, all of the totality of the circumstances with regard to this client. Of course, sometimes, as I just said, you know, there's just no question about it. There's nothing to look at. There's nothing, you know, this, I had a man in my office yesterday, 94 years old, okay? And I mean, I kid you not, I think he knew more about the politics and public events right now than I did. Asked me when I had to go on to vote and what my thoughts were about the Board of Education. I mean, amazing, you know, for a 94-year-old, sure. Okay? So there's just no question about a gentleman like that. He also, look at this, brought his only daughter to the appointment, wanted his son-in-law to listen in because he's very close with the son-in-law because he just has the one daughter.
Sure.
So, you know, you look at every little factor that is put before you. And after the experience that, you know, that certainly Wes has and I have, you begin to kind of see the patterns that develop. Closely akin to capacity, of course, is the issue of undue influence. You know, is this client brought to the office by a particular child? Is the parent living with a particular child? I had that file yesterday also where the mother is living with a particular child and the other child is in a different state, a southern state, but not North Carolina. And of course, there's conversations going on about how the child that has the residency of the mother in her home, how she can use her mother's money.
Sure.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And how to pay for this and pay for that and to maybe charge mother rent in the home or pay certain utility bills in the home. And of course, the conversation has to be about, I'm getting off track here a little bit, but the conversation has to be about, you know, you've got to be careful because you are the agent for your mother and her money, but it's her money. And it has to be used for her benefit. And you need to document this very, very clearly because of the fact that you do have a sibling who lives in a different state, isn't quite as connected with your mother as you are. You are the one that has the proximity to your mother. So you have the opportunity for it to be alleged that you are unduly influencing your mother.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that situation you just outlined there, Cecil, is very common, because we live in such, you know, we live all over the place now. Our families are
broken
up.
And yet if you're speaking to the mother independently, privately, and she rattles off all of these circumstances about her child here and her child there and how many grandchildren and where her bank account is, well, now you see very clearly that the lady has, you know, strong capacity.
We're talking with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell from Harvell and Collins, and if you'd like to call us now during the show, you can do that now. Call us at 252-247-7282 or after the show. They'll be back in the office, and the staff is there, 252-726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We're talking about some of the elements involved in last will and testament, including the capacity and competency of
capacity,
those.
Legal capacity.
And
so let's kind of hammer it here, right here. The first requirement is that the testator of the will, the maker of the will, be aware of their family. Known in the law, which always gets a little smile and laughter, known as the objects of your bounty. Okay? And you must know the objects of your bounty. How many children, maybe how many grandchildren, you know, as much detail as you can give, the higher the capacity would be determined to be. Secondly, you need to know the nature and extent of your assets, of your estate. You don't have to know that the stock market went down 1,000 points just today and that your stock account now is down, you know, ever how many dollars. You don't have to know the exact balances in your bank accounts, but you need to know generally whether you own property, where it's located, as in house land, mm-hmm. things of that nature, lots, condominiums, townhomes. You need to know generally where you bank. And you need to know whether or not, like Wes mentioned, do you have stocks and bonds or are you just an all cash person with, you know, plenty of money in the bank account and 3, 4, 5, 6 CDs? You know, what's the nature and extent?
Mm-hmm.
Notice extent as well as nature. Nature meaning bank, stock, bond. What's the nature of your estate and what's the extent of it?
So okay. somebody could say, I have a bank account at Bank of America and I have a position in the stock market.
And I have approximately $25,000
right.
in it.
Yeah. Right.
That's very different than I have a bank account at 4 different banks and I have $250,000 of CDs at 4 different banks. That's the extent of the estate being $1 million
yep.
versus the extent of the estate being I have a couple of CDs and they're about $50,000 a piece, Mr. Harvell. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you need to have you need to know the objects of your bounty. You need to know the nature and extent of your estate. And the third element of legal capacity, testamentary capacity, would be that you understand the effect of the document that you're signing. In other words, you know, I understand that this is the way in which I'm going to divide my nature and extent amongst my bounty. This is the document that is going to control the way in which my assets are divided and to who they go to. That I understand that the document that I'm signing is a document that will dictate where my asset, that's the effect of this document. Okay? Now, then the other side of the coin to this, Mike, is that the testator doesn't have to, you know, they can be confused at times. They don't have to know every single, you know, account. They might miss one or two. They might be a little having a bad day, having a bad morning or afternoon, things of that nature. But what a good lawyer with experience is going to do under those circumstances is then meet with the client another time. You know, document the file that you're meeting with them on more than one occasion. And proceed forward, okay? Again, you know, these facts and circumstances come at good lawyers in every conceivable shape and color.
I would imagine, too, a client perhaps may, like you said, they may not have it all out there on their initial meeting with you, but you at least get a foundation and a basis, and then maybe on that second come, when they come back, you can fill in the blanks, or they might say, oh, by the way, I forgot to mention this. I have a place in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't talk about that, so you can add that to their list. So it may take more than just one consultation to get it all, as you say, Cecil, nailed down. To nail it all down.
Right. So, you know, kind of from a broad perspective, the standard, if you're listening here, you know, closely, you'll see is pretty low. You know, it really is a pretty low standard when we're talking about what is testamentary capacity. You have to know, you know, who your family is, what you have.
Right.
And the effect of the will, kind of understand, as doctors would say, cause and effect to have that capacity. And sometimes we have cases in which it's a close case, like Cecil indicated. Normally what we do when it's a close case is we do solicit some opinion, you know, from the caring physician. You know, if someone is a close case as it relates to their capacity, they probably have a physician that they see pretty often just for other things because they're of advanced age,
mm-hmm,
you know,
sure.
typically.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, if it's a close case, then we like I said, we kind of pump the brakes. Let's ask the family to then have the doctor evaluate the testator, the client, the patient, and then provide in writing the opinion with regard to whether the person has the capacity or not. Sometimes the doctor would return, you know, an opinion that the person doesn't. Sometimes the doctor would return the opinion that the person does, and provide that detail. So we just, you know, it doesn't help the attorney at all, you know, obviously to press forward on the thing. We need to make sure there is capacity. And, you know, 99 out of 100 cases, it's really not a question. 99 of 100 cases, you're able to have the conversation, get the information. The person's able to give you all the feedback. They're able to answer the open-ended questions, and it's not a concern. It's like, Mike, if I'm sitting here talking with you, I can kind of tell you have capacity.
That's debatable. Don't say anything.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I said kind of.
Yeah.
Right. I could kind of tell you have capacity, Mike. I don't know. Cecil, not so much, because you called you Ben last week.
That's
so
all right. I was questioning Cecil's capacity. Yeah.
So we maybe need to find out who his doctor is.
Well, no, it's true. It's true, Wes. When you talk about and you're asking questions, where do you have your financial instruments and all this? And I'm going through my head and I got that, but I would be talking in. Yeah, kind of vague, vague on the others, but at least
generalities.
That's
what you need to have. You don't have to have those details of, I have $9,413.13 at Bank of America. I mean, you don't have to know that, but you have to have the capacity to know where your assets are and where it is in general.
In that rare instance, Wes, you talk about when you get to that point where you may have to pump the brakes, take a pause because of the question of whether or not capacity exists.
Right.
And then you go to a medical professional, and if they return a I don't know verdict, I mean, where do you go from there if the person's,
under the law, you do have some options of, you can videotape. I mean, you can do some things to gather evidence that make it more clear.
Yeah.
You can have a conversation that you record. You can do these type of things. You don't normally do that.
It's rare.
It's rare.
Yeah.
But under certain circumstances, you have those options to gather and secure evidence.
There is a chapter, a section in the North Carolina General Statutes that allows a lawyer to take a client before the court to declare that they have testamentary capacity.
So therefore
on the front end there is a determination that they have legal capacity to make a will. Now that's highly unusual, but it is there.
It's a good thing it is. It is rare, but there are remedies, there are steps to take after you try the initial, get the physician to sign off on it and all that. If you want some more advice on this topic or others, you can go to harvellandcollins.com or give them a call, 252-726-9050. We're going to take a short break and we'll return with the final segment of Let's Talk Legal. We'll take your calls if you have time to call, 252-247-7282. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal, and we're talking about last will and testaments and the legal capacity and legal competency of individuals. Wes, you want to add about medical records, how they play a part.
I say this quite often, where the rubber hits the road, but the rubber hits the road in a lot of different areas in which we practice. And in this capacity issue, and when a will's being challenged, in many cases, the rubber hits the road when we get all the medical records for the person who signed the will. The subject will. And, sometimes those medical records indicate that there's a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. Sometimes the medical records would indicate that there's a determination or presentation of dementia of some sort. Sometimes there was, maybe the treating physician has conducted an MMSE, mini mental state examination, which is the short examination that just treating, not neurologists, neuropsychologist, but just your treating physician can kind of quickly administer as basically a dementia type screening tool. Sometimes that comes back questionable. What is surprising to me, a lot of people think, laypersons, they think over the years, I've heard them say before, well, daddy can't make any decisions now at all because his doctor found he had dementia. Well, you know what? A lot of people, their medical records show dementia, show that there is some level of dementia. And every doctor I've ever talked to over the years indicate that, someone with mild, even moderate dementia, they normally are going to have testamentary capacity. they normally, and once you explain to the doctor, okay, here's your testamentary capacity. Let's be sure we're clear. You speak the medical, I'll speak the legal.
Right.
The standard is, do they know their family? Do they know their assets? Would they understand that they're making a will and the effect of the will? What would you say about this patient? And in many cases, the doctor doesn't really remember the patient. The person's died. We've seen a lot of people. But looking back at these records, there was a moderate dementia presentation. There was a 19 out of 30 on the MMSE. Most likely, this person would have that capacity. So the jump to the conclusion that just because there is a dementia presentation or even Alzheimer's, early Alzheimer's presentation, doesn't mean the person does not have capacity. You've got to dig a little bit deeper. Now, certainly, when we get more advanced with regard to different types, I know we don't have much time, different types of dementia, Alzheimer's, certainly the opinion could be there's a lacking of capacity.
There is a lack.
Right, right.